Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on Ring of Fire, author and journalist William Grider will tell us why the Democratic Party needs to find a more populist path. Melanie Sloan from Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington will talk about her group's call for bribery investigations of members of Congress. And author Wendell Potter will tell us how PR rhetoric is killing progress in Washington. You can follow Ring of Fire on Facebook or on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. Keep up with the latest progressive news on our website at ringoffireradio.com. And you can watch Ring of Fire every Sunday at noon on Free Speech TV. And if you want to help support Ring of Fire, go online to ringoffireradio.com/support to find out how. Remember, your support helps keep us on the air. Let's get things started today with the Ring of Fire News of the Week, the biggest stories from progressive media you may have missed. Joining me this week is best-selling author Cliff Schechter. So, Cliff, thanks for joining us this week. And, of course, this week's major story continues to be the conflict in the Middle East between Israel and Hamas. And, of course, the story really is ultimately the amount of really mass punishment and that the Israelis are inflicting upon the Palestinian people in Gaza. This week saw the Israeli government attempt to align themselves even more so with the Republican Party in this country, in part by attacking Secretary of State John Kerry for going ahead with trying to forge some type of truce or mediated settlement between the parties. Right. And yet for that, he was roundly attacked.
And they leaked actually some attack. They purposely leaked some comments about him that were not so flattering to their newspapers in a particularly, I would call it, disrespectful way of handling things. It wasn't sort of like they got up and they showed together that they were, you know, we haven't made progress yet and whatever. It was really a sort of, you know, a knife in the back, so to speak. But, and you know, I mean, Bibi Netanyahu has been a Republican for a pretty long time. I mean, if you look at him, foreign leaders have a practice of not endorsing anybody, and he endorsed Romney in 2012.
That's
he also had a well-known extramarital affair, which usually makes one a Republican. I'm just kidding, of course. Not really. But in any case, he's been an extremist on their policy for a while. Nothing's changing there. I mean, you put Netanyahu, if Netanyahu's running the show, I don't, you know, and they're building more settlements, I just don't see how peace is ever possible when he's where he is.
Yes, indeed. And frankly, you know, the Israeli population has been largely supportive of what the Israeli government is doing. And, you know, the reality is that in this country, our politics are such that very few politicians will ever criticize Israel. Very few politicians will even, in many respects, provide any empathy for the Palestinian people who
right.
are being subjected to, in Gaza, living in an open-air prison, in the West Bank, living under occupation. And then, of course, we have mass casualties of civilians on the Palestinian side. A couple of civilians have died on the Israeli side, but literally a couple. On the Palestinian side, you know, we're talking hundreds of children, and some reports from the UN, 70% are civilians. And here's the thing that, you know, of course, I know that you I imagine that you, but I certainly don't particularly enjoy talking about this topic. It inflames a lot of people on both sides.
That's
but
right.
If you leave aside any of the debate upon who has a legitimate claim to the land that is now Israel, If you leave aside any of the claims of morality, et cetera, at the end of the day, this is unsustainable. And the policy that Israel seems to be exercising, and we focus on their policy because they are clearly the ones in power here.
That's right. And I'll say quickly to me, because it's not, I don't focus on them to in any way, act like those, particularly members of Hamas, or have anything but blood on their hands, and don't purposely try to target Israeli civilians, and don't purposely try to stir up trouble and lead, you know, and they want this conflict too. Who we're talking about here are the vast majority of the Palestinian people who end up being caught up in this. And, you know, I would hope that you know, I'd understand if you live in a country where there are rockets flying in, you'd be more supportive of something like what Netanyahu is doing. But that doesn't change the fact that you also need to retain your compassion for civilians. You know, when we were hit on 9/11, there were some voices in this country who just talked about going around nuking random places in the Middle East. It didn't make me think, you know, having been in New York and frankly almost being killed that day. And I'm not saying I've ever been under constant assault like Israelis have, but it still doesn't make you suddenly go and want to kill civilians in a country where you know leadership. It didn't make me want to hurt Afghani civilians who I knew had nothing to do with it.
The point too is that, look, this is a physics problem. You cannot occupy a group of people. You cannot leave them in an open air prison and literally put them on a diet, as Israeli government officials have stated
terrible.
In the past that they wanted to do. Literally limit the amount of calories they could intake on a daily basis. You cannot do this and expect no response. And at the end of the day, it does not matter if you're driving a bus, full of convicts. You're driving the bus, and Israel in this instance is driving the bus. They are in the power position. They are exercising a policy that no one seems to be able to figure out where this ends, what this leads to. And they are losing support in this country. Now, it may be the case that the $3 billion that we offer in terms of foreign aid to Israel would give us no leverage in the future. But the Israelis cannot expect this forever. If you look at the polling, you see that support for Israel and our policies of supporting Israel drop off precipitously under people under the age of 50. When you look at Congress, you see that the it is really the conservatives, in many respects, the Christian Zionists, who have a far less critical perspective on what's going on in Israel than those who are Jewish in this country. And ultimately, this is going to catch up with Israel. It may be, again, that we have no leverage with them, but in the end, this is unsustainable for the Israeli
government. I don't interrupt you, Sam, but it's not even catching up with them from the perspective of what we do to them. It catches up with them to what happens to them, you know, in the Middle East and what happens abroad, and hatred for them Arab governments are then much easier for them to use especially some of the more corrupt ones, to use this to sort of demagogue against all Jews and against all of Israel and convince their own populaces to hate the other, as opposed, you know, it just makes it that much easier. It hurts Israel to do this. And that's in the end. I mean, whether we change our policy or not, the thing is, I'm not sure. I agree 100% with you there, because, you know, we've watched as, you know, right now we don't have a very good functioning democracy. And the sad thing is, really, the people who write for most of the major organs out there, not just Jews, but non-Jews, in the United States and appear on major television, and those in Congress, because as you pointed out, these Christian, you know, Zionists as well as, you know, more liberal Jews on other issues are sort of have somewhat of a coalition that, you know, it's the same way that you can have 70% of people wanting an increase in the minimum wage and 90% wanting background checks and whatever else, and yet it doesn't end up happening in Congress. That's my concern, is that, you know, they don't reflect the actual opinion of the rest of us out here. And my concern is that we just keep supporting them no matter what they do. And it doesn't help them. You know, I don't know. I don't know why we didn't seem to get this with Iraq, and still don't always seem to get this with Iraq. I don't know why Israel.
Yeah.
you know.
All right, well, Cliff, let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some more news of the past week. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar, here with my buddy Cliff Schechter. Let's get back to our discussion of the Ring of Fire news of the week. So, Cliff, let's focus for a moment on something that is ostensibly only has to do with New York State. Now, as you know, I'm a New Yorker. I know that you are a former New Yorker. And ostensibly, this has to do with New York State, but it really does also have to do with the broader progressive movement in the country and the issue of Democrats who still hew to that sort of old DLC, New Democrat model, where socially you could be liberal, but when it comes to economics, you govern and legislate like a Republican. And of course, I'm talking about our governor here in New York State, Cuomo, or Andrew Cuomo, who I refer to as Cuomo the Lesser.
Yeah, that's about right.
And here's a guy who you and I in the past have criticized for things like cutting the millionaire's tax in New York State, cutting
right.
the estate tax. Cutting important and vital services to people in communities around the country.
Saying he's in favor of campaign finance reform while undermining it every way he possibly can.
Which exactly.
Is familiar, isn't that, to what we're about to talk about?
Indeed. Indeed. And he is also in the past, he's cut corporate taxes. He's come out and said that he sees government, their primary function is to be a protector of the charter movement. In other words, privatizing our schools.
That's right.
And so he got a challenge from Zephyr Teachout. She is a lawyer at Fordham University who had been studying actually government.
A law professor there.
A law professor, I should say, right. Yes. Who whose specialty, I should say, or focus of study and teaching is government corruption. And sure enough,
what a coincidence.
Yes, and sure enough, this week, a blockbuster story in the New York Times that Governor Cuomo. Well, you tell us about the Moreland Commission.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's you know, I guess I would say it's the kind of thing that perhaps in the past would have been a little more astonishing. I mean, in light of what we're seeing now with Chris Christie and Scott Walker and one scandal after another, with the sort of floodgate of money that's been opened up by Citizens United and the McCutcheon decision and the complete sort of posture of this Supreme Court when it comes to the relationship of wealthy individuals and businesses to government, it's not as shocking anymore. In this particular case, there's been plenty of corruption in the state legislature with a number of guys either indicted, going to prison. You know, you had a former Senate leader who was trying to bribe his way into the mayor's race. And so basically what Cuomo himself called for this Moreland Commission, named after a past commission that looked into corruption, to try to make it look like he was doing something about it. This is a very, by the way, popular thing that Cuomo does, where he did that with campaign finance reform, too, and other issues, where he makes it look like he's actually doing something and cares about something when really he's trying to do just the opposite behind the scenes. And what came out in the New York Times is that every step of the way, he was undermining this commission. Basically, he had his people contacting them. A number of emails were gathered by the New York Times and put in this piece and showing that he had his people essentially when they wanted to start looking into a political consulting firm with ties to him, they couldn't do that. When they wanted to start looking into some of the people who were connected to him and his administration, no, they had to keep their focus on the legislature. And eventually, he basically shut it down. I think it was supposed to be open for, 18 months or something of that sort. And he shut it down in about 6 months, seven
yep.
months, something. And, you know, this is, I don't know a better word for it than Nixonian, although maybe I should call it these days Christonian. You know, he seems like he's holding hands quite literally and figuratively with his friend Chris Christie across the river there. Of course, they share a lot of the same funders like Ken Langone and others, yep. Big hedge fund guys. So I guess this shouldn't be surprising. This is sort of the corruption. This is emblematic of the corruption we're now seeing that goes beyond party. That there's so much money floating around almost in the open in politics that you know, I mean, basically Cuomo created a slush fund for himself from yep. money from these guys. So why should it be shocking? And you know, this is the kind of thing that clearly, if he's guilty of, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt of innocence as we do in our system. But I have my suspicions that he is quite guilty, at least from that report. You know, he needs to be held. He needs to be tried for this. I mean, people. He needs to go before a jury, not quite of his peers, of his lessers, as you might say.
Well, indeed. Well, you know, I will say this. I mean, it's unclear whether or not he violated any laws, although the U.S. attorney from the Southern District of Manhattan is looking into that. But the real thing is quite clear is that he basically corrupted his own anti-corruption commission. And what the end product is that we have a guy who is basically legislating and functioning as a governor for the benefit of those corporate interests and those wealthy interests that pay him campaign donations. And
that's
so,
right.
You know, this race in New York with Zephyr Teachout is going to, you know, she's definitely running. I spoke to her on the Majority Report this week. She is definitely running to win. But I will say this, if she does well, at the very least, it will send a message to Democrats across the country that you simply can't get away with governing like it's 1995 anymore.
That's right.
That era is over.
And you know, particularly in progressive states.
Yep.
You know, this neoliberalism needs to be shut down.
Indeed. We've got to take a break, but we'll be right back after this. Just ahead, Melanie Sloan from Crew will be here to explain her organization's call for an investigation into potential illegal activity from Congress. I'm Sam Cedar, and we'll be right back with more Ring of Fire. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. The Supreme Court's decisions in both Citizens United and McCutcheon cases have allowed donors to pour almost unlimited amounts of money into political campaigns. But there are still a few congressional laws in place that make it illegal for members of Congress to trade votes for campaign cash, a practice that has become all too common in modern politics. Joining me now to talk about the fight to expose some of the bribery taking place among our elected officials is Melanie Sloan, the Executive Director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. So Melanie, Crew, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, your organization, has asked the Department of Justice and the House Ethics Committee to investigate assertions made by Representative Vance McAllister, Republican from Louisiana. Tell us what those assertions were and how it came about.
Back in June of this year, Mr. McAllister was at a meeting of the Northeast chapter of Louisiana CPAs, and he recounted as an example of how money controls Washington and how things work on Capitol Hill, that there's a steady cycle of voting for fundraising and money instead of voting for what's right. And he explained that a colleague on the House floor told him flat out that he would receive a $1,200 contribution if he voted against a bill related to the Bureau of Land Management. And McAllister gave a whole long talk about it. And he said, I played dumb and asked, how would you vote? And he told me, vote no, and you'll get a $1,200 check from Heritage. And if you vote yes, you'll get a $1,000 check from some environmental impact group. And McAllister said, this was a surprise. And I said, are you serious? And he told me, yeah, wait and see. McAllister then said that he voted against the bill but didn't get the $1,200, but he checked back with his colleague who said he did get a check. And then McAllister refused to identify the colleague, saying he didn't want to put their business out on the street. And then later, after this was reported, he backtracked completely and said his comments were taken completely out of context, and he never cast a vote with the expectation or anticipation of receiving any money for a vote. But obviously, I just think he just didn't realize that when he was talking about it the first time, he was talking about bribery.
Right. I mean, and it very well may be that he didn't cast his vote that way, although it sounded like he was going to get a net $200, at least in his mind. But this basically exposes a wider dynamic that we know is problematic. We just don't hear many of them talk about it this way.
Right. This is, of course, what most Americans suspect is going on in Congress all the time, that members are paid for their votes. But most members of Congress are smart enough not to talk about it in public. And here, Vance McAllister just admitted that basically folks are flat out paid for their votes. And what's so distressing isn't even so much that Vance McAllister would say that, it's that then there was a deafening silence from the House Ethics Committee and from the Department of Justice. We have a member of Congress talking about being offered bribes for votes, and nobody even thinks it's worthy of an investigation.
And so what happens next? I mean, they've gotten your request, and I guess it's just a matter of public pressure.
I think it is a matter of public pressure, and I would really encourage your listeners to demand an investigation, call their members of Congress and say they want an investigation by the House Ethics Committee, not that we can trust the Ethics Committee, but why would the Department of Justice not want to investigate when a member of Congress says that he was offered a bribe?
Well, you tell me, why wouldn't they?
Well, from my own perspective, it's incomprehensible, but I think that the public integrity section of the Department of Justice has not been very aggressive or very assertive in investigating this kind of thing. And I think that some of it is difficult to investigate because members of Congress, the way our system, our campaign finance system is set up, it basically is legalized bribery. The fact of the matter is most of the folks who donate money to members of Congress are not just local constituents who give them $25 or $50. They're lobbyists and members of trade associations who in turn do in fact want something for their money.
What this reminds me of is the Supreme Court ruling in Citizens United, where it was made as an assertion of fact, I think it was by Justice Kennedy, that there is no sense that if we allow unlimited corporate donations, that we would in any way either be corrupting our government officials or even showing the or creating the perception that our government officials were corrupted. And in some respects, this seems like one could add this on the pile of evidence that at the very least, McAllister, for a while, perceived it that way.
As I said, this seems to be what happens in Washington all the time, although I think most of the time people are a little more careful about what they say. They don't say, I'm going to give you $1,200 if you vote for me, but they might say, this very issue is very, very important to me, and we're going to, you know, thank you for your support. We're so appreciative of all your longtime support, and that's more how it works. Although lately we've seen fundraisers happening very close in time to votes on important pieces of legislation, which I think is always troubling. But here we have people even openly talking about what we all suspect to be true, and even that isn't enough. So the fact is, you have to wonder what it would take for the Department of Justice to investigate, if not a member of Congress who is talking and his words are taken down by a member of the media, if that isn't enough to get somebody to investigate, like, what do you actually need?
Right. Apparently, he would have to show the check, I guess, take a selfie of himself. And,
right, show him depositing it.
But often what we hear as a response to these type of charges in general is that, well, yes, of course, this organization is funding me because I'm the type of person who votes in a way that lends itself to these people giving me support. So in other words, it's not a quid pro quo. It's just simply an alignment of interests.
Right. And certainly that is probably what happens frequently on all sorts of issues, particularly social issues, is my guess. You know, somebody is not going to change their views from being, say, pro or anti-choice or pro or anti-gun control based on one contribution, but they're the people who care about those issues might contribute based on that member's role overall. But I think often on these business votes that are not the kind of votes that a member's constituents might notice, it's a lot easier for a member to say, well, you know, I do need to build up my campaign war chest, and I know that there's money coming in if I vote X way, and my constituents don't really care, and frankly, I don't really care, so I'm going to do it.
And so what is the solution here? I mean, you know, obviously, you know, we can have the and it doesn't look like it's going to happen, but obviously it would be nice to have popular pressure on the Ethics Committee and on the Department of Justice. But what is the broader solution? I mean, is this something that's just endemic and we have to accept it? Or are there larger reforms that are needed to essentially rid us of this dynamic?
Well, I think it is endemic, but that doesn't mean we have to accept it. I mean, it is our government, and we can demand better from our politicians. We should be throwing out members of Congress who looks like are, in fact, voting in favor of their largest donors rather than in favor of our interests. So one of the things we all have to do is pay attention. You know, everybody thinks that members of Congress are corrupt in general, but they like their own member of Congress. And I think people need to take a much closer, harder look at their own member of Congress and the way their money's coming in and notice that, for example, most of these members, you know, by the vast majority of the money that they raise, they don't even raise in their own district. They raise it from outside their district. And why is that? Because they're doing things for different corporate interests, and we should be concerned about that. So I think people need to start supporting things like public financing, and there have been bills for public financing at the state level across the country. I think we need to be demanding that members of Congress push for legislation like the Disclose Act that would reveal more of the secrecy behind the who the donors are, behind some of the secret money that is so often used in our campaigns. Because, you know, this kind of money that we're talking about with Mr. McAllister, which is just a $1,200 check, this is really now chicken feed in the landscape of the kind of money we're talking about. Because while you can only contribute a couple of $1,000 to any particular member of Congress or congressional candidate at any time, if you're going to contribute to 501c4, which allows secret donations, or you're going to contribute to a super PAC, you can donate literally millions of dollars. Indeed. And we as the public often don't know who's behind that money.
Melanie Sloan of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Hopefully we'll see some type of response to this, at the very least, from the public. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Melanie Sloan is the Executive Director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, D.C. Coming up, we'll hear from Richard Eskow, host of the Zero Hour, about the latest Republican attacks on Social Security. I'm Sam Cedar, and we'll be right back with more Ring of Fire. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. Republicans have been attacking Social Security since its inception, and recently their attacks have reached a new low. They're actually attacking disabled Social Security recipients. I recently spoke with R.J. Eskow about the issue at Netroots Nation 2014 in Detroit. Let's hear what R.J. had to say. Let's talk about something that, and I know you and I have talked about Social Security in about half a different ways. You have a great piece up that people can find over the past month about the secret attempt to harm Social Security by closing down its offices. And you know, of course, you hurt customer service. You begin to weaken the strength of the program, which is that people love it. But another thing that I want to talk about, because this has been floating around and it has the smell of one of those issues that we're going to hear from the right wing. It sort of came up a couple of years ago. PBS ran a story, or 60 Minutes, I think, ran a story that was full of fallacies. And that is Social Security disability.
Right.
Now, before we go into the attacks, just tell people, because I don't know that everybody realizes that it's SSDI,
right.
That it's Social Security. This is a part of Social Security. Tell us about that.
Well, people get Social Security disability coverage in two ways. One is if they've never worked and they've always been disabled, there's a form of insurance that covers them. But the bulk of Social Security disability insurance comes from the money you pay directly in, just the same way that your retirement benefits do. Comes from that money. If you get hurt on the job, it's a form of government-sponsored disability insurance that says you'll get a certain... not generous, but you'll get a certain amount of money if you get injured on the job. job, and it's tied to how much you've put in and that your wage base and all that. So this is, like Social Security retirement benefits, something we pay for, a form of insurance.
And and the premiums come in the form of payroll taxes, and our premiums are matched by our employer. And all right, so Social Security disability, the story that we've been hearing now since the crash in 2008 is that Social Security disability insurance is rampant with fraud, that the claims have gone through the roof, and that it is just, it is a fraud-ridden program and something's wrong. That's story A that we hear from the right. There's also a story B, which is that the trust fund for the disability insurance is going to run out in 2 years, I think it is now, which is much sooner, obviously, than the retirement insurance capacity. Let's take the second one first.
Right.
Where are we at with disability insurance in terms of the trust fund?
Well, first of all, yes, the trust fund, which is much smaller than the retirement trust fund, has, quote unquote, run out of money. It's a melodramatic way to say, you know, has a cash flow issue. Congress has already dealt with this 11 times. And it's very simple.
Just 11 times?
Just 11 times. And what they do is when that fund needs a cash infusion, temporary cash infusion, emphasis on the word temporary, then they take money out of the other fund, which now has more than $2 trillion in it. They keep it going, and then they rebalance it. Everything gets squared away. Congress, Republican Congresses have done it. Democratic Congresses have done it. It's never been an issue. This time, all of a sudden, we hear that Senator Orrin Hatch and people in the House are going to make a big issue of this is a crisis and this is an emergency and we're not going to bail them out. We have to confront a fundamental problem, which, by the way, doesn't exist. Any long-term actuarial imbalance is easily fixed in a number of ways. But as a staffer to a Republican senator said very candidly to a writer in the Wall Street Journal, Senator Hatch wants to use this to leverage a much bigger discussion. And that bigger discussion is cutting Social Security.
Yeah, this is the hook, right? I mean, we see this with the Highway Trust Fund is going through its own situation right now. Let's not get into it. But these funds periodically are set up in certain ways as not to keep pace with inflation. In this instance, what we're looking at is really a rather predictable demographic, or should have been predicted, demographic blip. Right? I mean, isn't that when we hear that there is just so many people on disability, how is this explained? There seems to be a fairly straightforward explanation for it.
Well, one, absolutely straightforward. There are a couple. One is, compared to other developed countries, we don't have a lot of people on disability. We're comparatively difficult to get on. The process is made extremely difficult in this country. The rules are strict, but because of the cutbacks in the offices, it can take more than a year to get on. And can you imagine being disabled at work, losing a limb or something, and then being without your benefits for a year? I mean, that's inhumane. But and once you get on, our benefits are the worst of any developed country except Korea. So, but you hear these scare talks about, and the other explanation is, look, our workforce is getting older,
right,
so people are going to injure themselves a little bit more on the job. That's also a factor. But isn't it ironic that the same Republicans who want to keep raising the retirement age higher and higher and higher are also upset that older workers are becoming disabled more? The way to prevent that is to lower the retirement age.
Right. Well, let's be clear. It's not just Republicans.
Sure.
I mean, let's be clear. There's, you know, I haven't heard... Well, you know, we hear raising the retirement age for Medicare floated around, which is also even almost more ridiculous. And we hear this from, if not Democratic politicians, although I imagine we hear from some, certainly some of those Democratic politicians appoint special commissions. Simpson Bowles comes to mind.
Sure.
And we certainly hear it from some supposed liberal commentators that, you know, why being so chaste about the retirement age? And the reality is the retirement age is going up.
Right.
It is 65 now for full benefits, but by the time I retire, it's going to be 67.
Right.
And so the...
Right.
This is a demographic. I mean, we have an aging workforce. More chance to be ill, I guess, and to become disabled. I would also imagine that going through a period of financial insecurity makes it that much harder as well on some level in terms of just creating. We know stress creates chronic disease, and this also has an impact.
Well, presumably, but I think that gets exaggerated, too, because I think that one of the things the right likes to do is say, well, they're all shirking, you know, they're all, or they're afraid they're going to get laid off, so they jump onto disability. The system does not really make that very easy to do. And as to your other point, you know me, I don't give Democrats a free pass.
Right.
I'll be pretty rough on them on this stuff. On the disability issue specifically, I'll say it's been the Republicans pushing that one, and at least we've had Sherrod Brown as
right.
really being a great voice for it. And the leadership, Obama and so on, they really haven't said anything about the disability issue up to now that I've tracked.
This sounds like it may be a fall campaign type of push.
Right.
I mean, that we're going to see from the Republicans. It's a great way to sort of imply they're on the side of Social Security benefactors, of old people in general, while still sort of like implying that the disability is really a way for non-white people getting a shake, right? I mean, they're sort of built, custom-built for that.
Yeah, you bet. You know, I mean, look, they're always trying to turn, and I would include some Democrats in this, one kind of American against each another, right? And so they had, and it was Obama's appointee to run that deficit commission, Alan Simpson, who used the phrase greedy geezers. They tried to demonize old people, but that didn't work because everybody who votes is either old themselves or loves somebody who is.
Well, and Alan Simpson is clearly an advocate for young people. I've seen some of his parody videos.
He's younger than springtime.
Right.
But look, you know, so the greedy geezers thing didn't work out. So you got to find another scapegoat. And I think you're right on the money. I think the issue here is, you know, the shirkers.
Right.
The ones who don't want to work so hard. And you might say
lazy. I mean, what are we talking about for an average disability payment from Social Security?
You're in the range of a little over $1,000 a month. I mean, we're not talking about big dollars here.
Right. This isn't, I've taken the opportunity to go and buy a bungalow in Tulum, Mexico, and on the beach. This
right.
is basically, I'm able to eat, and I'm
right.
able maybe to pay my rent. Richard Eskow, senior fellow of the Campaign for America's Future and host of The Zero Hour. You can find it at thisisthezerohour.com. Thanks so much for your time today.
You bet, Sam. Thanks for having me.
When we come back, Cliff Schechter and I will be back to discuss even more of this past week's biggest news stories. I'm Sam Cedar, and we'll be right back with more Ring of Fire.
I'm Mike Papantonio, and you've been listening to a free sample of Ring of Fire Radio. If you'd like to listen to the full show, subscribe to our weekly podcast at our website at ringoffireradio.com. It's your support that helps keep us on the air.